Yes, hello, and we are back here. This is Warning Shots here on CKUW 95.9 FM. Warning Shots is CKUW's independent international news show. I'm your host, Scott Price. And right now joining me on the line is Rick Rozoff, manager of Stop NATO International. He's been on the show numerous times, although this is the first live appearance. Joining us from Chicago. Rick, hello.
Hello, Scott. It's always an honor to be on your show.
Yes, well, thank you. You've always been a frequent and a very gracious guest, so it's always a pleasure to have you on and talk with you. So let's talk about this recent tour that U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton did in Africa in July. She visited Senegal, South Sudan, Uganda, Kenya, Malawi, and South Africa. So let's talk about some of the implications, programs, and policies that are linked to this trip. So let's first talk about Senegal. What kind of role does Senegal play within United States policy on the continent of Africa, Rick?
Senegal is a key military client of the United States, arguably the major one in West Africa, more so than Nigeria, for example. And the significance of her launching her, what turned out actually to be a nine-nation tour. I had originally, the State Department had originally mentioned the six countries you mentioned. Towards the end, they tacked on three others in West Africa, which we can talk about in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
But Senegal is important in a couple of capacities. It's a member of the Economic Cooperation Organization of West African States, ECOWAS, which, as your listeners know, has been, there have been attempts made to have ECOWAS militarily intervene in Mali over the past month. Earlier than that, in Ivory Coast last year, using a combined military force. And the ECOWAS collective military force is really the nucleus or the prototype for what would be a West African standby force. The African standby force is an initiative of U.S. Africa Command with assistance from NATO. And the original intent was to have five regional African standby commands corresponding to the five major economic communities in Africa. So the one that Senegal is a member of, ECOWAS, is, of course, West Africa. And Senegal has been in the forefront of pushing for military intervention, first against the government of President Laurent Gbagbo in Ivory Coast last year, currently in Mali, and potentially against other countries. Senegal is also a key link. As a matter of fact, you know, arguably the most significant member of what's the U.S. calls the Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Initiative, which is a U.S. AFRICOM, U.S. military initiative, but it's a successor to the State Department. This is where Clinton comes into the picture, to the State Department's earlier Pan-Sahel initiative, which was launched in 2002. And the intent, or the ostensible purpose of both, you know, the current Pan-Saharan counterterrorism initiative, is to hunt down alleged al-Qaeda elements in northwest Africa. And that's largely a front, of course, for the U.S. moving in to engage in counterinsurgency wars, such as the one they've conducted in Mali, with the Malian military for at least 5 years now against Tuareg militias. So Senegal is the key hub and the key regional West African military ally of the United States. So It's no coincidence she began her trip there. And as you mentioned, she went from there to Central Africa, then to East Africa, then to South Africa. But in fact, and this may have something to do with the recent death of Ghanaian President Atta Mills, that Clinton decided to tack on or add on visits to Nigeria, Ghana, and Benin. So altogether, she was in nine countries. But as geographical adjectives we've used demonstrate, they're everywhere except North Africa. It's west, east, south, back to the west. She traversed, cut across the continent pretty thoroughly in her trip, and in the course of doing that, visited some. Most of the major strategically important countries on the continent, Senegal and Uganda certainly, but even more so Kenya, South Africa, Nigeria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I'm glad you brought up the Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Initiative and also Mali, because I mean that's an interesting thing, because we've done some coverage of Mali on the show. It seems, you know, with these Tuareg rebels, it says al-Qaeda linked, and to them, as well as this whole Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Initiative, is ostensibly to combat Al-Qaeda-linked forces. Although, I mean, it's questionable what the links are. This seems to be thrown around very uncritically. So I'm curious, maybe I didn't catch it, but so when did this Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Initiative start?
It followed up on the State Department's Pan-Sahel initiative. When was the start? I would guess about 2005, thereabout.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, 2005, exactly.
Yeah. Now, as I also understand, so Senegal's also been pushing very hard for intervention in Mali as well?
That's correct. And last year, as I mentioned, in Ivory Coast, the current president of Ivory Coast, that is he who was installed, with the because of pressure by the United States and NATO allies, but most particularly last year when French troops and helicopters assaulted the presidential offices, or residence rather, and strong-armed and abducted Laurent Gbagbo, is when Alassane Ouattara, who's a former World Bank official in the United mm-hmm. States and is both Washington and Paris's man in Ivory Coast, has been clamoring for military intervention in Mali also, so that the pattern establishes itself where somebody planted through Western subversion and intervention in turn, starts a campaign to intervene in the next country and on and on.
Yeah.
But West Africa is clearly, of all, outside, of course, Northeast Africa with Somalia, where nations like Burundi and Uganda and Rwanda, actually Burundi and Uganda, with Djibouti now joining, as well as Sierra Leone from the other side of the continent, and Kenya now with a large military contingent intervening in the civil war in Somalia. Aside from that, would be the East African Standby Brigade, incidentally. And West Africa is the other one where the U.S. is really itching to set up a surrogate military force that can intervene. Prospective interventions recently would have been in Guinea-Bissau, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to recall that the main motivation for creating U.S. Africa Command was the initiative of several U.S. European commanders who are simultaneously, as your listeners may know, Supreme Allied Commander Europe for NATO. So the post is held by the same person. And starting no later than the beginning of this century, James Jones, Marine General James Jones, who was then both European Command and NATO top military commander in Europe, was pushing for a permanent U.S. and by extension NATO military presence in the strategic Gulf of Guinea and West Africa in the Atlantic Ocean, which, according to the Financial Times, a good decade or so ago, Scott, the U.S. at that time, 10 years ago, was importing 15% of its oil from West Africa, nations like Nigeria and Angola. I believe Nigeria and Angola are the two countries in Africa from whom the U.S. imports the most oil to this day. But the estimate in the Financial Times at that point was that the U.S. anticipated importing 25% of its oil from the Gulf of Guinea area, which has a double advantage of being reportedly very high-grade crude oil. And also, the U.S. could ship it on tankers directly across the Atlantic Ocean without having to pay duties or customs or going through any standard choke points and so forth. So that the creation of AFRICOM and the West African Standby Brigade, if it materializes as such, is really the brainchild of U.S. European Command, which ceded Africa to U.S. Africa Command in 2008. That is, almost the entire continent was in the area of responsibility of European Command, with the exception of Northeast Africa. And so we were looking at a joint Pentagon-NATO operation throughout Africa, but centering primarily in the Gulf of Guinea. That's mm-hmm. really where they want to install themselves.
Because you were talking quite a bit about it, this African standby force, I wouldn't mind talking a bit about that, because, it's nominally created, right? And then they did have some activities in Somalia, but at this point, it's from what I've read, it seems like it's still not quite off the ground yet, and there's big debates happening within the African Union about how this African standby force would even operate, who would have control over it, and who would even be funding this thing, because they, as they say, it would have to be foreign donors who would ultimately have to fund this thing. So it seems to me, though, at least in my observation, that it's not the standby force. Military intervention is always something that can get very complicated, but it seems like it could be something that might be positive, because at this point it's not completely within the hands of, let's say, NATO or Western control necessarily, right?
That's a two-edged sword. We have to recall that it's not actually the Eastern Brigade or East Africa Standby Brigade yet, formally, in East Africa, but it's under the rubric right now of AMISOM, African Union Mission in Somalia, where there are several thousand, I think at this point it's close to 14,000, Ugandan, Burundian, Kenyan, Djibouti, and other Western allies contributing troops to that. But as of 2 years ago in the spring, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization was airlifting Somalian, Burundian troops in and out of Mogadishu, a couple thousand in and out of Mogadishu.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps even as I speak, efforts by I've heard estimates from 12 to 15 different European Union nations, which means in almost every instance, NATO nations as well, NATO Partnership for Peace members like Ireland being the others, are in Uganda training Ugandan troops for deployment to Somalia. So that clearly how the Pentagon and NATO envision the African standby force is is a surrogate.
Okay.
Is one where they mm-hmm. train, they command, they ultimately support in their terminology. But in essence, as a matter of fact, a leading NATO official several years ago stated explicitly that the proposed African standby force was modeled after the NATO response force. The NATO International Response Force.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a model that's being used. By the way, the inauguration of the NATO Response Force was several years ago in Cape Verde, the former Portuguese island nation off the coast of West Africa, where it was large-scale military attacks, military exercise, amphibious attacks, air exercises and so forth. And this was the inauguration of the NATO Response Force, not in Europe, but in fact, off the coast of West Africa. So I think that signaled early on what the ultimate purpose of the NATO's intentions were, and what their global response force was designed to do, which is to intervene in Africa. And that's exactly what we saw last year, of course,
mm-hmm.
where NATO ran 6 months of military operations against Libya, naval blockade, and a fairly relentless bombing campaign against a nation of some 6 million people. And that was NATO's Africa Corps, if you will, the first endeavor in the continent.
Yeah. Now, talking about South Sudan, the link between the United States and South Sudan, there is that big link there. And and when I saw that there, I didn't see any, it didn't surprise me that Hillary Clinton would visit there, the newest African nation. Now, I'm curious if you could outline, because since I think about last fall, even in that area, there's been a lot of involvement of United States special operations within Uganda, Rwanda, and South Sudan. So could you talk about South Sudan and its role with U.S. special operations?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that, Scott. It was almost immediately after the formal declaration of independence by South Sudan that General Carter Ham, who's the current commander of U.S. Africa Command, showed up in South Sudan. I think it could have been, Scott, if I'm not mistaken, within a week.
Wow.
And as I've come to state it, when a new country emerges, and the one preceding, South Sudan was Montenegro, in 2006, within months, U.S. warships or military ships were docking in their harbors and so forth. The ink is barely dried on the the independence declaration before the Pentagon moves in and assumes control. So we have that by way of background with South Sudan. You were also alluding to the fact that the Obama administration last year deployed an initial contingent of some 100-some-odd special operations troops, actually to four countries in the area, in addition to South Sudan and Uganda, also to the Central African Republic and Congo. Again, allegedly to hunt down Joseph Kony or to, you know, disable the Lord's Resistance Army, but one wonders with what other intentions. So the fact that Clinton went to South Sudan to consolidate control of the world's newest nation, I think there's no other way of interpreting that. This is the same Clinton who, we have to recall, in June of last year, 2011, while in Zambia, warned the African continent against what she called the new colonialism. You know, and without mentioning China, clearly an allusion to China, you know, in so many words, isn't it terrible that somebody might consider coming and using African countries for raw materials and not reinvesting, you know, their profits in the continent, as though that's never been done, right? as though, you know, Britain, Germany, France, you know, Italy, Portugal, Spain had never done anything.
Canada, like that, United States.
Yes, right. But I mean, directly through colonization in the cases I mentioned. I mean, she's either that purblind or amnesiac about what has occurred. And she's also speaking as of October of 2008, the United States has placed the entire continent, save Egypt, which remains in Central Command, you know, under the control of the U.S.'s latest Unified Combatant Command. There are six now with the inauguration of Africa Command. And the U.S. alone in the world and alone in history has carved up the entire globe into six regional military commands, and Africa now is united under one. It had formerly been, as I mentioned earlier, largely under the control of U.S. European Command. The parts of it in the Northeast are under Central Command, and for a short while under Pacific Command. I'm talking about the island nations off the coast of East Africa, Madagascar, Seychelles, Mauritius, and Comoros. But now they're all under Africa Command, with the exception of Egypt. But she's innocuous to that. And I think when we talk about U.S. Africa Command, Scott, we have to remember, unique amongst the six Unified Combatant Commands, this is one that from its very inception was defined as being a joint Pentagon and State Department initiative. That is, the State Department is an integral part of U.S. Africa Command. So when Hillary Clinton goes to Africa, she's not going strictly as America's top diplomat. And by the way, I choke every time I use the word diplomat in reference to her. As bad as her predecessors were, she may very well, you know, exceed them all in terms of just being a reckless and you know, unbridled provocateur, and, you know, making statements, as I mentioned, about China being a new colonial power in Africa and such like, or some of the milder statements that have emanated from Clinton recently. And for anyone for the stomach to watch it, you can go to YouTube and watch her dancing in Malawi in South Africa.
Now, Rick, the other thing in the other country that came up as you were talking was Kenya. Now, the interesting thing about Kenya that reading into this is that it's now one of the newest bases for drone strikes, is it not?
That's correct. There are three new countries, actually, maybe four. The U.S. has been launching drone strikes out of Djibouti in northeast Africa, where they have, at Camp Le Manier, the headquarters of what's called the Combined Joint Task Force Horn of Africa, which takes in, depending on how, you know, they counted, 14 to 17 nations in the area. There's no question about that the U.S. has launched drones, surveillance drone missions, and probably Hellfire missiles launched from drone predators inside Somalia and Yemen from Djibouti. But the other is, you're correct about Kenya, Ethiopia, and the Seychelles, you know, off the coast of East Africa, also having drone bases. And it was 3 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, where the U.S. set up not a predator, but a Reaper drone base in Seychelles, and initially staffed it with 100 or so U.S. military personnel. That became de facto the second, formal U.S. military base in Africa, the first being in Djibouti. There's still an estimated 2,000 to 3,000 troops, incidentally, in Djibouti and Camp Le Manier. So that you have an increased war theater, if you will, in the Indian Ocean, but the Arabian Sea, really. That area off, really, that separates the Arabian Peninsula from Northeast Africa, and that's I don't have to tell your listeners, a very strategically important point.
Yeah.
A place in the world right now. It includes, for example, you know, where the Red Sea enters the Arabian Sea, and, you know, the Suez Canal connecting the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean Sea. But also, if you look at the, you know, drone warfare going on in Yemen and Somalia, that's just an important place to be, and the U.S. Africa Command, in large part, is no surprise to me. Then, the U.S. set up its first military base on the African continent in Djibouti.
Mm-hmm. Now, with Kenya too, they have also been kind of, I guess, what you could define as more of a client state to the United States in the past.
That's right. I mean, historically.
Historically, moving on to the last country, but in South Africa, because South Africa isn't, they're not necessarily completely aligned necessarily as some of these other countries are, but is this sort of the key cog to be courted in this whole AFRICOM picture, as South Africa has the current ANC government has inherited one of the most advanced military apparatus from the old apartheid government. So to talk about South Africa's kind of key, how it's the key cog in all this with the activities of the United States on the African continent.
That's a vital point you've just made, and you've described it perfectly, that because of the military power that was built up during the apartheid years in South Africa, with the active assistance and connivance, you know, Western NATO countries, the United States, Britain, former West Germany, and others, that, and Israel also, not to leave them out, that there is a military infrastructure, military industry, one of the better developed, if not the best, navy, including submarine force, in Africa, at least in sub-Sahara Africa, and that it's vital then, for much the same reason, say, a country like Ukraine is in Eastern Europe, for the same reasons, that it's vital for the United States to build closer state-to-state, but particularly military relations with South Africa, which is also the linchpin for the South African Development the SADC,
mm-hmm.
that, as goes South Africa, basically, so goes Southern Africa, and that, nations like Zimbabwe and Angola and so forth, though important in their own rights, if South Africa could be secured more thoroughly in the Western column, the U.S. column, the possibility of using, South African military intervention in or against Zimbabwe, possibly in Congo and so forth, becomes a prospect the U.S. is probably considering. We do have to recollect, though, in recent years, last decade or so, that the South African military is engaged in joint military exercises with the United States and with NATO, or with other NATO powers, at least not officially with NATO, and that there is a concerted effort to try to push South Africa off the fence, if you will, more solidly towards the West. At the most recent vote in the UN Security Council on Syria, which Russia and China, for an unprecedented third time, jointly vetoed, earlier having done so this February and last October, only Russia and China voted against the resolution targeting Syria. Of the 15 members, 5 permanent and 10 rotating members. However, it's revealing the two countries that abstain, which were South Africa and Pakistan.
Hmm.
And as I think I indicated an article ahead of Clinton's visit, which culminated a week ago. She wrapped it up on August 10th, she was going to have some words for the South African government of Jacob Zuma, about that abstention. And I'm quite sure she did. Also, as I had occasion to mention, she made a point of meeting with Nelson Mandela, but most people probably aren't aware that her own State Department, I mean, not hers at the time, but the State Department that she now heads, only 4 years ago, if you will, decertify the African National Congress, Nelson Mandela's organization, as a terrorist organization. It was still formally branded a terrorist organization up until 2008. And I can recall in the 80s, that at the very top of the list of the U.S. State Department's terrorist organizations were Nelson Mandela's African National Congress, Yasser Arafat's Palestine Liberation Organization, and Gerry Adams' Sinn Féin, Irish Republican Army. And in the interim, of course, all three of the leaders I just mentioned were welcomed to the White House, and two of them won Nobel Peace Prizes. So this shows the, you know, just abject, I was going to say hypocrisy, but almost, you know, political debauchery of U.S. foreign policy, that when an ally determines that a liberation struggle is a terrorist organization, then the U.S. brands it similarly and treats it accordingly. You know, as in the case of Northern Ireland or Palestine or South Africa, and then turns right around and has Hillary Clinton visit Nelson Mandela as though they've been fast friends for decades.
Yeah, so, I mean, is it closer to South Africa being courted into all this, do you think? Or is that, or is there still some shaky ground there between South Africa more jumping in with the United States?
You know, and I know that the ruling political party, the African National Congress, now is comprised of various components, including COSOCTU, the Trade Union Federation, the youth group, and so forth. And I don't think there, I mean, I know there is not complete unanimity, you know, within the ANC and its affiliate groups about domestic policies, particularly pursuing neoliberal economic policies. And I think foreign policy-wise, too. And last year's war against Libya, which we have to recall, even though the U.S. maneuvered, Hillary Clinton maneuvered to use the Arab League to give some stamp of authenticity to the, you know, impending war against Libya at the time, that, you know, Libya is an Arab country, but it's first and foremost an African country.
Mm-hmm.
And at no point was an effort made with the African Union the way it was with the Arab League, and the Arab League now being dominated by, being purchased by, you know, the wealthy petro-monarchies in the Persian Gulf that are the West's key allies in the Arab world, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and, you know, such like backwards, despotic, benighted regimes, which were used to overthrow the government of Libya also, and now are targeting Syria. But, you know, the fact that the U.S. attacked an African country that, or NATO attacked, U.S. and NATO attacked an African country, raised a lot of ire throughout the continent, as you're aware.
Mm-hmm.
And if not by the government, certainly in the press. And statements coming out from, you know, Nigeria to Tanzania, from South Africa, and from the youth group of the African National Congress in the first place in South Africa. And, you know, not only condemning the U.S. And NATO for what they were doing to Libya, but condemning their own government. You know, in the case of South Africa, having voted for Resolution 1973 in the UN Security Council at the time, you know, raised a lot of dissension, a lot of animosity amongst the populace of African countries towards their governments for either not having opposed it or, in one sense, you know, voting for the resolution, you know, essentially endorsing it.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to kind of wrap it up. We're getting to the last bit of the show here, last couple minutes. But thanks for coming on and giving all this very pertinent and important information that, you know, sometimes I've mentioned on the show that, you know, sometimes I wonder if other Western news sources even have African coverage, and you've given us quite a bit, so I thank you for that. But kind of what we were talking about actually before we went live on air, you talked about the need to have this sort of alternative information network and why that's important. So maybe if you could kind of just explain what you mean by that.
Yeah,
to the audience.
Would, you know, your own radio program being an important example of the sort of information outpost that, you know, we need to, you know, connect with internationally, and we need to shore each other up. What we were talking about, as you recall, Scott, was the fact that the Internet, more than anything else currently, gives us the ability to discover other people and other organizations that have been functioning, you know, languishing, if you will, in comparative obscurity, you know, conscientiously ignored by the corporate media, and that all of us have been evolving, you know, an internationalist, an anti-militarist, but, you know, a common international perspective, oftentimes in isolation, and that it's incumbent on us you know, to seek out and support each other. I'll give you a poignant example recently. Somebody I don't even know who put me on their mailing list sent me a link for an article in the Daily Times in Pakistan, which was an absolute superb, you know, analysis of Western plans for South and Central Asia. And I posted it on the Stop NATO website.
Mm-hmm.
The following day, the author, who is a Pakistani, writes in, thanks us for posting the article, provides additional information, and that's the sort of thing you can do. You can just multiply that.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where, you know, I link your site on my website, you know, your radio program has
yes.
my website, and I think there's a real obligation on our behalf to seek out and support each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a question of, you know, whether we all agree on every particular, it's a question of whether we're committed to, you know, progress collectively in the direction of, you know, expanding our knowledge, you know, analyzing the events more effectively, and jointly getting out the information as you're doing, you know, with the intent purpose of, you know, combating what, you know, I just posted an excerpt from Kwame Nkrumah's remarkable book, Neocolonialism, The Last Age of Imperialism, on the website, which is still a book I'd recommend people hunt down if they can find it. It's probably not in print. But that, you know, we need to revive ideas that seem to have, you know, gone into quiescence or dormancy. You know, over the past 20 years, where there's been a lot of depoliticization, there's been a lot of defeatism. And I would just urge in the strongest possible terms that we, you know, unite with others of like mind and heart around the world and really strive to create an information collective.
Yes, well, here. That's all I got to say to that. So Rick Rozoff, manager of Stop NATO International, thank you for coming on. It's always a pleasure having you on. And I hope to talk to you soon, Rick.
Thanks again, Scott, very much.
Excellent. Thank you. Have a good day, Rick.
You too.
That was Rick Rozoff, manager of Stop NATO International. Frequent contributor here, as well as on, I've seen him on Russia Today a couple times as well, and other news sources. If you look up Rick Rozoff, Stop NATO in Google, you will be able to find his information and what he provides.